In her article, Contraception, Why Not?, moral theologian Janet Smith writes, "Many years ago, when I was first teaching at Notre Dame, I taught Humanae Vitae in my ethics class. I asked the students how many of them thought that contraception is moral. All of their hands went up. How many have read Humanae Vitae? None of their hands went up. I said, how many have thought about the topic for 3 minutes or longer? None of their hands went up." Now, these are college sophomores, she goes on. So it's a bit unfair to expect college sophomores to have read Humanae Vitae. I was, however, making a point. They had made up their mind about contraception without having done any thinking or reading about it. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and your host for these After Dinner Scholar podcasts. For most Americans, contraception is simply part of life, requiring no more thought than whether to eat lunch or to bathe regularly. It's just done. What most of us don't know is that for more than 1,900 years, every Christian church taught that artificial contraception was a grave sin. That changed in 1930 when the Anglican Communion ruled that contraception by married couples in certain limited circumstances was permissible. In 1931, the Federal Council of Churches, precursor to the National Council of Churches, followed suit here in the United States. And in an editorial response, the Washington Post said, quote, "Carried to its logical conclusion, the committee's report, if carried into effect, would sound the death knell of marriage as a holy institution by establishing degrading practices which would encourage indiscriminate immorality. The suggestion that the use of legalized contraceptions would be, quote, careful and restrained, close quote, is preposterous." 37 years later, on July 25th, 1968, 50 years ago, Blessed Paul VI promulgated his encyclical Humanae Vitae, restating what Christians had believed for nearly two millennia. The rejection of artificial birth control was met with shock. Where did the Pope get these ideas? With anger, how dare he? And with dissent that 50 years later continues to plague the Church and the world. Today, Humanae Vitae continues to be an encyclical that is as unheeded, as vilified, and as unread as ever. To discuss what Paul VI actually said and why it matters, I'm joined by Dr. Kent Lesnowski and Dr. Jeremy Holmes for this somewhat extended version of the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Lesnowski, let's start with the historical context of this encyclical.
Sure, that's an important place to begin. In the 60s, there were lots of expectations of the church changing its teaching on contraception. And we might be thinking, why is that? Well, of course, we have the sexual revolution going on. But beyond that, population growth and the concerns around the lack of resources, especially in the third world, and where the difficulty of providing for large families, even in the middle class first world, was on a lot of people's minds. The church was concerned that governments would take harsher measures than contraception to take care of this perceived problem of population growth. For example, forced sterilizations. Also, you have the specter of eugenics in the background here. During the earlier part of the 20th century, population control was thought to be handled by making sure only the right kind of people were having children. And so forced contraception and sterilization for eugenic purposes is in the background as well. I think perhaps the most important thing culturally, though, is the rise in the understanding of the dignity of women, and also the rising consciousness about the importance of married love at the center of marriage. And so with these two issues, the church said, look, we need to be able to restate the age-old teaching on marriage and contraception in the language that people are speaking today. And today they're speaking the language of love. And so the church and the Pope in his wisdom decided to write this beautiful document to address these issues in a language that people could hear.
Well, you mentioned love. That's a word that has all kinds of definitions. And what do we need Dr. Holmes to understand in terms of the language of the encyclical?
Well, right at this point in time, as you say, love is a word that has been bandied about a lot in the public square. And people need to keep in mind the basic intuitive fact we all have before us, that loves are not all the same. The love of a parent for a child is not the same as the love of a best friend in high school for a friend. The love of husband and wife for husband is not just generic love. It is a specific love that Pope Paul VI refers to as conjugal love. And it is something that goes beyond friendship. It is a friendship, but more specifically, it's the kind of friendship that involves a total self-gift, not only of soul, but also of body. As Pope Paul VI is very concerned that we get past a kind of spiritualistic understanding of ourselves and realize that we are embodied souls, and spousal love is a soul-body fused love that involves bodily union as part of a spiritual union. Right, so it's conjugal love does not consist of sort of two pieces that sit next to each other, a spiritual union, and then over here, a bodily union, as though you could pick up either side when you want it. But the conjugal union is, just as the soul and the body make up one being, so in conjugal love, spiritual love and physical union make up a single conjugal love. That makes it different from all the other loves that people are talking about these days.
And to add on to that, people have looked at Pope Paul VI's definition of love and found a few sort of catchwords to hang their hats on. And we hear these in his definition of love in section 9, where he, first of all, calls it fully human. And I believe that's what Dr. Holmes is getting at with this close connection of body and soul. You can't take or leave one or the other. But then he goes on to tease out what that means. For it to be fully human, it has to be first and foremost free, a gift of the will. It has to be total. It has to be faithful and exclusive. And then finally, it has to be fecund or fruitful. It has to bear new life into the world in some way. So you've probably heard this before in Catholic teaching or Catholic apologetics, but that married love is free, faithful, total, and fruitful. It's a way that people tend to shorten or condense the definition of conjugal love these days.
Okay, well, with that, what is the Pope's argument for this age-old Christian understanding of how to regulate births?
It seems that the Pope is taking two approaches here. First is to restate the more traditional argument about natural law, that humanity and its nature and all the things that make up a person have ends built into them, and that we cannot do violence to God's intention for the ends of human activities.
And I'd like to step in and maybe clarify a bit about that segment of his argument, because it's frequently misunderstood. That is, the sort of parody one hears of Paul VI is that, oh, you're not allowed to mess with biology.
Right.
If the body has a physiological function, then you can't step in and interrupt it. But we all know that you can, right? Doctors do this all the time, even in extreme ways. So doctors will put someone into an artificially induced coma for weeks on end, or there are some situations in which doctors shut down the immune system in order to save the patient from some kind of terrible consequence. And the reproductive system also admits, as the Pope says, of medical interventions. So it's not as though there's something magic about the wiring of the body, that you're not allowed to fiddle with the wires. Rather, it's the fact that we have to get into the way the Pope is thinking of this. He's not looking down on the body as something outside the person to be messed with or not messed with. He's keeping in mind that this body we're talking about, the wiring we've been talking about, is us. And so the ends that are built, that Kent was referring to, that are built into the body, are things that our reason naturally sees as good. So when we talk about not interfering with the ends built into nature, we have to think of that in a first-person way. That is, the things we see as good, we need to respect as good, right? This is not a biologistic, mechanistic kind of argument. We are embodied souls. The ends of the body are also the ends of our reason, the things we see reasonably to be what's good for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And so as we think about how to regulate what it means to be a person and the various aspects of human life, they come under the heading of what I would guess is sort of the second approach, which is virtue that he's talking about here. And he says, we need to regulate the use of our married life according to virtue. Now, there are many virtues. One of them is conjugal love itself, but there's also prudence and generosity. So what he's trying to do is shift a little bit away from the natural law language, which, as Dr. Holmes pointed out, is easily confused and reduced, into start using this language of love. And he says, well, if marriage is about love, well, then let's see if there's something about love that can teach us about how to use sexuality within marriage. And so that's why his definition of love as being a free gift, a total gift, a faithful and exclusive gift, and a fecund or fertile gift of self and reception of the other, that definition controls the way sexuality is expressed, and it sort of rules out contraception. Right? For example, you're not giving totally if you're withholding part of yourself in sterility or in contraception. You're not giving yourself, your love isn't truly fruitful if it's not open to the gift of life in the marriage. Okay, those kind of things are at stake. Then he's using the words prudence and generosity when it talks about how do you decide what responsible parenthood is. So you can't just decide how many children to have based on your own subjective desires. You have to have prudence and generosity. And figuring that out is part of the challenge for Catholic married couples today.
I've heard married couples who profess Christian faith talk about parenthood as if it's a special calling for some married couples and not for others. How would Pope Paul have responded to that? And how does spousal unity and procreation go together? And in that, would you talk about this doctrine of totality?
You know, Christian couples speaking that way have two avenues open to them. One is, from the Christian perspective, one can look back at the biblical witness, and there is a massive case to be made from the Old Testament that marriage is all about family and children. Right from the beginning, you can start making that case that the one flesh union was never meant just to be Adam and Eve hanging out together in the garden, enjoying their retirement, but it was going to be about filling the earth, being fruitful and multiplying. But perhaps even more widely available than that, Paul VI is saying this is part of the natural law, and what that means in Catholic speak is this is among the principles that are self-evident to human reason. Now, people can get confused about the things that are self-evident to human reason, but just as when you're reasoning about, philosophy or science, you start with certain things like a thing can't both be and not be at the same time in the same respect, or the part is greater than the whole, or whatever. There are also certain principles in the moral life that you start from. Things like do good and avoid evil. We don't need God to reveal to us that should be our policy. It's immediately evident to practical reason that that's the case. And he's making, I think, the wonderful, bold, surprising claim that what he's saying about marriage is in that category of principles available to reason. Therefore, available not only to every Christian couple, whether or not they've heard a auditory locution telling them to have children, but even to those outside the Christian fold.
So totality is a way of arguing for contraception that has been used for many years. And the idea here is that, well, my marriage on the whole is fruitful. And so if that's the case, then surely not every act of marital consummation must be open to life, because on the whole or in totality, our marriage is fruitful. The Church has, and Pope Paul VI here rejects that argument, saying that we must be able to assess and consider the moral goodness or evil of each action that we take as a person. Each action involves the work of the conscience. And the conscience is our power to discern and listen to God and identify what's objectively good and evil in our given situation. And so whenever we act, we're using that power, whenever we make a decision. So to say that we can sort of zoom out and look at the wholeness of a relationship and find the morality only there rather than each action is a kind of reductiveness that doesn't seem to make sense when we start applying it in other cases.
So for example, someone might say, on the whole, as a pattern, when you look at my life as a pattern, it is clear that my wife and I have a relationship of mutual trust. So the fact that I'm lying to her on this one instance, that's not a sin or an immoral deed because it's subsumed into the larger pattern of trust in my life. Now, if you're a spouse, does that sound right?
I don't think so.
And, you know, Paul VI and then, of course, John Paul II picked up on this in a big way. The popes speak of the conjugal act itself as having a signification. It's a meaning. It's like speech. And so John Paul actually uses the analogy of the lie to describe what's wrong with contraception, that you say, on the whole, yeah, sure, we're all about kids. This one time, my sexual act is going to mean not really. Mm-hmm. And, oh, surely that's okay. And John Paul points to the parallel with language to say, no, we can all see that's not okay. Mm-hmm. The marital covenant is established in part by the conjugal act. And when every time we return to the conjugal act, it needs to mean the marital covenant again. Mm-hmm.
Or said differently, that the conjugal act is a restatement of the wedding vows themselves.
Let's talk about the Pope's predictions in the encyclical. When I read these as a Presbyterian pastor, Pope Paul VI really got my attention. What did he predict? And 50 years later, how are we doing?
Well, I think Paul VI, if he were here today, would be both amazed at how right he was and astonished at all the other fallout there has been that he didn't even predict. But to start with what he did predict, he immediately said there are going to be these consequences of general loosening of morality and general loss of respect for women, that we'll see a trend towards more ability to use women as tools once the men using them don't have to deal with any consequences. So ironically, while contraception was billed as liberation for women, in the event it seems to have been a kind of liberation for men who don't want to have to worry about how they behave themselves. That's a return to the virtue argument that Kent was referring to earlier, that when the Pope comes down to contrast, say, periodic continence with the use of contraception, what he zeroes in on is periodic continence requires self-mastery. You actually have to change your sexual behavior to flow around this reality of marriage and procreation. Whereas what contraception is, essentially, is it is an attempt to have a sexual relationship and just not have to worry about ever modifying your own behavior. You don't have to master yourself in order to move forward with this. And what that does is it lets the sexual impulse kind of out on its own. It sort of opens the gate and the sexual impulse leaves the yard and starts roaming around, not under anybody's supervision. And that's going to go in these directions of more widespread extramarital unions, less respect for women, less human relationships.
And one of the biggest concerns around contraception and hopes for contraception was that it would make marriages better. There was a lot of fear about, well, we need to abstain and that's going to be so hard. And what if we have affairs and what if we can't do this? And so people thought it's going to give people a lot of peace and rest from their anxieties if they have contraception. And so they're going to have more joy in their marriages. Well, of course, we've seen the fruit of not only contraception, but then it's mixed with no-fault divorce laws in the skyrocketing divorce rates. It really has not helped marriage in the way that many of its advocates thought it would. That's another important piece of this puzzle.
There are, of course, other things that have developed after Pope Paul VI's predictions, some positive, some negative. On the positive side, I would say that under the impulse of Humani Vitae and his teaching, we've had a wonderful growth and insight into such things as the value of periodic continence, coming to see that abstaining for certain periods is not merely a negative thing. It's not merely the absence of sexual intercourse. It actually is itself a kind of spousal behavior which tends to promote communication and trust and love, tends to make the spouse feel valued by the other spouse, because you're respecting her situation. So that it turns out that abstaining is not simply not engaging in marital relations, it's engaging in a spousal procreative behavior in a different positive way. Not something that's as clear, I think, in Humanae Vitae, but definitely the seeds were there and he provided the impulse to that. Mm-hmm. But on the negative side, something we've seen more and more clearly is that once the tethering of the marital union to procreation is gone, that is, the basic rationale behind why is conjugal love different from every other love, it's because it has a connection to procreation. Once that's broken, we find that even Catholics who enthusiastically thought this is going to be great for marriages and so on start coming up empty on arguments, why should homosexual marriage not be just as legitimate? Why should inherently sterile behavior patterns not be okay when in fact we've just granted that you can have real conjugal love with no connection to fertility?
And another piece on the positive side is the striking developments in science and fertility studies, as well as women's health around the issues of fertility as well. You've got the Paul VI Institute out in Omaha, which is doing marvelous work, as well as Marquette University. Dr. Richard Faring is doing excellent work there on all these issues. The amount we know about women's reproductive health has gone through the roof, largely thanks be to this document and the great work of John Paul II. So women who were struggling with fertility years ago and had no answers now have answers related to the study of woman's cycle and their rhythms and their hormones that we wouldn't have been able to help them with. So I think we can praise God for the intervention of Paul VI here and John Paul II and all the energy that had been put behind understanding women's fertility since then.
And you mentioned John Paul II. We have to put his pontificate on the side of the positive developments. Paul VI laid a certain groundwork and gave a certain argument, but I think it has to be admitted that John Paul II deepened and clarified Paul VI's teaching so that what Paul VI is doing is there, but it's not as clear in his document as it is in the teachings of his successor, John Paul II. And so those who are interested in following up on Humanae Vitae would also do well to look into the theology of the body and the very extensive teachings like in Familiaris Consortio, just the brilliant work done taking what's in Humanae Vitae and developing it further in its own line.
At the end of the encyclical, Pope Paul wrote, "In preserving the whole moral law of marriage, the Church is convinced that she is contributing to the creation of a truly human civilization." How does Humanae Vitae and the affirmation of the moral law contribute to the creation of a truly human civilization? Another way to put it is, how is this good news for not only Catholics, but for everybody?
Well, on the one hand, understanding sexuality as part of the human totality, what it means to be a person, is to me an enfleshed soul, not a soul that has a body machine that it operates, not a ghost in a machine, right? So the contraceptive mentality tends to mechanize the body and look for means to achieve whatever the ends of the soul, the real you are, by means of the body, the machine that you're operating. Whereas the Catholic Church and Paul VI are trying to say, no, these things are integral and can't be taken apart. The truth about humanity is the integrity of the body and the soul. And so this teaching tries to maintain and encourage that integrity. The good news here is that the Church, in its teaching on marriage and sexuality, isn't somehow only relevant in a medieval worldview and a non-scientific worldview, a worldview that doesn't care about love. The more we look into the nature of love in its fullness, and the more we look into the science behind how humans work and their cyclical reality for women, we see that those two pieces, a deeper understanding of love and its nature, a deeper understanding of how the body works, actually promote and give strength and buttress this teaching of the Catholic Church more than anyone might have thought it would. And that's very good news for us. We don't have to run from the world. We don't have to run from knowledge. and science. We don't have to run from the way that people want to try to understand married love.
And there are so many people who are unconsciously thirsting for the vision you just laid out, Kent. They are engaging in sexuality that's divorced from fertility, divorced from family, divorced from commitment, and their experience is they're coming up empty. They feel so flat. They don't know why something that seems like it should be delivering so much meaning comes to feel so empty. And the reason is because they're only engaging in it with a part of their person. The good news is don't pull away from that as though because it feels meaningless, it must be bad or need to get away from it. Go deeper, put more of you into it. Put your soul, in addition to your body, into this. Retether it to lifelong commitment, total giving, fertility, that list of attributes of conjugal love. And then it actually does begin to deliver what people's instincts thought it should. It will only deliver it in the context that Paul VI has laid out here. And that context turns out not only to deliver this immense satisfaction for the individual who has been seeking it, but those who find it discover their own depth of meaning in life was never meant to be simply their own. This love that they're seeking actually founds a little community and becomes a wealth of goodness for others. The real authentic conjugal love between a husband and a wife becomes a treasure not just for them, but also for their children, also for their relatives, also for the community they live in. It becomes a kind of touchstone and a point of stability for much more than just the one person who started off lonely and desperate seeking meaning in life.
Scholar Mary Eberstadt commented, "There's hunger, notably, though not only among the millennial generation, for an authenticity that many find lacking today. The teachings embodied in Humanae Vitae are a radical challenge, an invitation to consider what a real alternative to the dominant culture looks like." That alone is reason to read or reread Humanae Vitae and to heed its teachings. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.